From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Thomas Friedman joins us in the studio. He's just back from visiting Yemen, Syria, and Turkey. We'll talk to the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist about his thoughts on the turmoil in Syria, U.S. jobs, and NSA surveillance, among other topics. He's in San Francisco to host The Next New World, a New York Times forum on technology and the global economy. Thomas Friedman, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's program. This is the second hour of the Forum program, and in it we're going to be talking with New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, Pulitzer Prize winner, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, who's joining us in studio for this hour. He's the author of such books as From Beirut to Jerusalem, which is now out in paperback, and The World is Flat, Hot, Flat and Crowded, and The Lexus and the Olive Tree. And he's in San Francisco to host a New York Times forum on technology and the global economy called The Next New World. We welcome Thomas Friedman back to Forum. Good to have you here.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Well, where do we begin? You just got back from the Middle East, so I have to begin with the Middle East. I got about 100 topics to cover. And yesterday we talked about the G8 and the impasse with Syria. Are you at all sanguine about meeting in Geneva or about that any kind of breakthrough with Russia where they are and all this polarization can move forward?
No, I'm not. I think the best way to think about it, Michael, is to start from 30,000 feet. So what's going on in Syria? What's going on in the Middle East more broadly? What we're actually seeing is the true implications of the end of the Ottoman Empire. Okay, so the Ottoman Empire broke up almost exactly 100 years ago. And when it did, the effects on governance were in some ways delayed because we had the British and French to come in, manage all these minorities and communities as colonial powers for their own, you know, self-interested reasons. But they kept the region under control. They then turned it over to iron-fisted kings, dictators, who eventually gave way to iron-fisted, you know, generals and colonels. And they kept the lid on the place. They ruled the Middle East, all of them, I would argue, vertically, from the top down with iron fists. Now, there's no more British and French. There's no more Ottomans. There's no more kings, or there's very few kings left. And the iron-fisted dictators are all gone. So what you're left with now is the peoples of the Middle East, of the former Ottoman Empire, with only one option left: to rule each other, to work together vertically, not horizontally.
But there's still vertical ruling by Morsi. Maybe just substituted for Mubarak. There's still vertical ruling by Assad until he's moved out of power. And
well, but you see, neither one has the kind of control that their predecessors had at all. You know, so what I'm saying is the only way these countries can be stable now is no longer with the iron fist, but if the people themselves can come together to write a social contract on how to live together as equal citizens with equal rights, with real rotations in power. And the question I have, question people there have, is can they? And if they can't, what are the implications?
Can they, in light of the fractionalization, I mean, even in the opposition, which we're now aiding, not militarily, you've got probably everything from al-Qaeda to would-be democracy advocates of the best type, and how to sort them out, and who knows where it's going to lead ultimately if they do displace Assad.
And that's the danger. The danger is that they only agree on one thing, and that is that Assad must go. And as soon as Assad's gone, they have fundamental disagreements on how government should work and what the values should be.
It's Shia and Sunni to a great extent, isn't it? I mean, as we're seeing now with Russia and the United States lining up on different sides with Syria on one hand, you know, Hezbollah and Iran, the United States doesn't like that, although they don't know, as we've been saying, what's going to happen in the aftermath of possibly Assad being removed. But it seems to be boiling down to Hezbollah and Iran on the one hand, and maybe the United States and Saudi Arabia and other Western powers.
And Qatar on the other. You have, if you imagine, when the lid came off in the Arab world, basically three aspirations came out. One aspiration was to be citizens, to have real democracies, to say where people had equal rights and responsibilities. One aspiration came out to be more sectarian. I want to be more Shiite, more Sunni, more Alawite. And one aspiration came out to be more Islamist, okay, to have rule by and of the Sharia. So what's made—
There are even different degrees there, like the Salafists.
Right.
And,
yeah. Exactly. So what's made this region so different, say, from Eastern Europe, where when the lid came off, the vast majority of people wanted basically liberal democracy and to be members of the European Union. In the Middle East, you have these three at least, and each one has a sub-branch to it, contending forces. And that's what's making it so unstable.
Well, in a recent column you did, you've been to Syria, Yemen, and Turkey. I want to talk about, the whole region. But let's talk about Yemen for a moment, which doesn't get talked about a lot. And you were pretty hopeful, it sounded like, or so I read your column, hopeful about the broad-based dialogue that's going on there. You even said Obama should give a shout-out because Yemen looks like it's moving toward a new constitution. Women are involved, all kinds of social media. But we associate Yemen as al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula. We associate it with a place where you had to hit American citizens with drones. I mean,
yeah, it's so Yemen, obviously.
And with chaos, I should add.
Yeah, and, but it's actually, of course, all these countries, when you're there on the ground, looks a little different, not quite as frightening. Why was I a little more optimistic about Yemen? It goes back to the fact, Michael, back in the 80s, late 70s and 80s, I lived through years, I guess it was four through nine of the Lebanese Civil War. I was actually on the ground. We lived in Beirut during the Lebanese Civil War. And I learned something from how the Lebanese Civil War ended with the Taif Agreement. And it ended on one principle. No victor, no vanquished, that we've got to find a way to balance everyone's interests and live together. So the reason Yemen is actually had an advantage over the other Arab awakening states is because of a crazy set of circumstances that wasn't planned. The leader, Ali Abdullah Saleh, was had to step down from power, but he wasn't forced out of politics. So he and his supporters, who are significant, are part of the transition process, and they have buy-in for that process. To put it in the simplest terms, there was no de-Ba'athification there. So you didn't have this huge aggrieved constituency that had power and suddenly found themselves stripped of it. And as a result, you have a very broad-based dialogue there.
Talk about de-Ba'athification. Let me, before we go to the current Middle East, go back with you to a time we were together at UC Berkeley and Maureen Dowd was with us, and you kind of turned to me in some surprise and said, boy, you know, I'm not getting as much flack for my position on Iraq as I thought I would be from Berkeley, this radical hub, or what we often identified and thought associated with the radical hub. And the fact of the matter is that there are many who continue to say you were wrong on Iraq because you favored the invasion, because you felt that Saddam Hussein should be removed. Let's make this current for a moment. I want to frame this question rather than have you know, defend your position or go back to that. What we see in Iraq now is alliance with Iran. We just said, you know, even though Iran's under new leadership, it's really pretty much under a different brand of or a different outward cosmetic, a guy with a smile, as somebody put it, I think. He's been a long supporter of the theocracy and the republic. So I'm just wondering whether you see a mistake just from a tactical, real politic point of view in terms of where Iraq is today. They're not our friend.
Well, let's be very clear. What I favored in Iraq, was partnering with Iraqis to build a democracy for the very reason we're having an Arab Spring here, So because I always understood that that was the underlying tension in the region, and that unless they found a way, basically, to produce consensual government, the whole region was going to blow. And not only just blow, it was going to have a become a human development disaster. So let's remember my support for the Iraq War was about democracy, not WMD or any of these other things. What do I feel about Iraq right
now? It's not a democracy.
Yeah, it's...
So Shiite, essentially...
It's much more complicated than that. And it's much more complicated than to say that it's an Iranian vassal as well. It's actually a very complicated situation. What do I feel about Iraq? I feel three things. One is whatever happens there, we overpaid for it. And for that, I have nothing but regret. Number two, you can overpay for diamonds and you can overpay for cut glass. What exactly we overpaid for in Iraq... I don't think
still
it's
not clear.
It's not clear to me. These are long term processes. I'm talking about, as I told you, the end of the Ottoman Empire. It's also playing out there very much. And my focus right now, and I think America's focus should be, not for my sake, for the sake of Iraqis who paid such a huge price, for the sake of Americans and Brits and others who paid such a huge price, to try to make what happens there come out in a decent way. Now, to say that Iraq has fallen into Iran's camp is so much more complicated than that. The fact that Iraqis have had free and fair elections, I think, is something that has impacted Iran, that the Iranians, look on Iraq and see that. I think it's influenced Iran. you know, unless we find a way, let's go back again to, you know, why I supported Iraq, trying to partner there with Iraqis. How did we treat the Arab world for 50 years? We Democrats and Republicans. We treated the Arab world for 50 years as a collection of big gas stations. Libya station, Iraq station, Saudi station. And basically we told them three things. We said, guys, it was only guys. Guys, here's the deal. Keep your pumps open, your price is low, and don't bother the Israelis too much. And you can do whatever you want out back. You can treat your women however you want. You can miseducate your kids however you want. You can deprive your people of whatever civil rights you want. You can preach from mosque whatever intolerance you want. You can print whatever conspiracy theories in your newspapers you want. Just keep your pumps open, your prices low, and don't bother the Jews too much. And it is my view, Michael, on 9/11, that we got hit with the distilled essence of everything that was going on out back. That's what al-Qaeda and bin Ladenism represented. And it was my view then, and it's my view now, that unless we find a way to partner with the Arab peoples to try to change what's going on out back by building decent, consensual government in line with the Arab Human Development Report, this whole region is going to be a human development disaster.
Well, we're still facing the possibility, certainly, of another 9/11. I mean, realistically. And let me just shift gears here for a moment and talk about NSA, because, again, you've taken a position that you've gotten considerable criticism
and
for.
Considerable support for.
And okay. Considerable support, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in fact, the country is very polarized
exactly.
on that.
So let's be clear about that.
Well, but let's talk about this from a perspective of, for example, Jeremy Scahill said, when you talk about the fact that you feel good about NSA surveillance if we've avoided another 9/11, and there are many people who obviously support that view, and in fact, General Alexander said—
I don't feel good about it. I said that I reluctantly, very reluctantly, see the trade-off and support the trade-off.
Well, I think it was, as I said, General Alexander said there were at least 50 terrorist acts that were interfered with and so forth. But I was thinking about somebody like Jeremy Scahill who said it's an out-of-control national security state. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that thesis?
Yeah, I mean—
I mean, he criticized you because he implied that you didn't realize the full extent of the nationals.
Look, I am deeply concerned. I'm glad people are on this case. I'm deeply concerned that you build up this degree of observation of people's lives, both through cameras and online, that it can be abused. The point I made in my article is my fear that if there is one more 9/11, something at the scale of 9/11, that the demands that you want to see an out-of-control national security state, you'll really see it if there is another 9/11. And therefore, I am reluctantly, very reluctantly, ready to accept the system that President Obama has put in place, and in part with his predecessors, of course, that says, you know, we're going to have this level of controls, this level of regulation, this level of oversight to prevent abuses in order to buy this level of security so we don't have another 9/11. Because if we do, Michael, I really believe that there's a lot of people who will be ready to accept a lot fewer freedoms in our lives.
Well, the freedoms in our lives, let me go. I think I mentioned you before we went on the air, Eric Schmidt, former CEO of Google, mm-hmm. now chairman, and Jared Cohen, his partner in writing a new book, were just here on Forum. And I said to them, you know, you guys have information about everybody. I mean,
they do. It's scary. That's creepy to me.
Talk about surveillance. I mean, they have the kind of information that even Snowden didn't necessarily even have access to with respect to, I don't know, phone calls and emails or whatever. Does this disturb you? I mean, because you're kind of a cheerleader of technology in many ways.
Yeah. Look, I believe that my whole view on globalization is that it has huge potential upsides and huge potential downsides. I didn't start it. I can't stop it. And I think our job is to get the best out of it and cushion the worst. This is in the category of the potential worst, something we have to cushion.
You also did an article recently on jobs, and you said the world has changed, which has been a Tom Friedman theme or motif for a number of years now in many of your books and columns. And you said you need a specific skill now, and you need to show value. Mm-hmm. And that's just the reality of it, you know, in terms of getting a job. And I agree with you. I'm just wondering, though, a guy like Snowden, he has a particular skill. But also the whole value of education, for example, went by the wayside. He didn't have a high school diploma. He was essentially a geek, so that he got the job that he needed. What was the screening in terms of security? I'm not even talking about his education. Yeah. What kind of screening went on there?
That I don't know, but in a way, it's a funny...
high-level intelligence security.
It's an ironic example of actually a very new phenomenon, which is that... I wrote about this a couple of weeks ago. You see, you have more and more employers today who really are saying, in effect, in exactly these words, but in effect at least, we really don't care what you know. We only care what you can do with what you know. And we don't really care also of your pedigree, your degree, how you got that competence to do with what you know. So you have this whole movement now in a lot of employers actually to really discount your resume, which is something you write about yourself, and even your BA to some degree or a graduate degree, and instead offer their own test. Google does this, in fact, a series of tests to determine actually what you can do with what you know. And Snowden's actually a perfect example of someone who developed, obviously on his own, tremendous set of competencies that allowed him to get hired at some pretty high-level jobs without the traditional pedigrees. And in that sense, I think he's an example of where a lot of things are going in the labor market.
Yeah, I'm afraid I would agree. And just how do you see the labor market now? I mean, how do you take the pulse at this point?
Well, I think that what is really changing is that the middle class, and this is my biggest concern, something we call the American middle class for the last 50 years, your parents and mine, was built on something called the high-wage middle-skill job. That is, you really could earn a very decent wage in this country with a middle-skill job in manufacturing and in services. Today, there is increasingly only a high-wage, high-skill job. And because what's happened is automation, software, robotics are every day eating up more and more of those middle-skill jobs. I mean, some is a simplistic one. That parking ramp you always used to go to, there was a man or woman there you gave your ticket to when you left, is now completely automated.
Jeremy Rifkin was right in part.
I think he was right. Yeah. Absolutely. And what's happening, though, Mike, is that's actually coming not just to the parking ramp guy. It's coming to lawyering. It's coming to accounting. It's coming to a lot of white-collar work now as well. And so everyone's got to find their unique value add, their unique value contribution that justifies why they should be hired, why they should be promoted. And that requires, I think, constant relearning and reinvention. That's why I always say I'm an old fuddy-duddy. I'm 59. My girls, when I graduated from college, I got to find a job. I think my girls will have to invent a job.
That's very sad. I mean, you think about, when I went to school, I thought there's possible career for me in academia. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was many friends who thought, lawyering, law firms closing down, not hiring, people terribly in debt, trying to get jobs in law. I mean, the whole landscape has changed. And you got young people trying to get into social networks or trying to, work in Silicon Valley, especially out here.
Yeah.
And that's where the opportunities are. And it's not necessarily, I mean, just again, the whole I see it as a shift in terrain completely. Speaking about terrain, you went to the Middle East and looking at not only post-Arab Spring but environmental stresses as a result of the Arab Spring, and you were there to also highlight, as you did in your columns, just how the infrastructures and education have been failing in these states terribly in the midst of all this chaos and so forth. And one can get pretty glum and grim, just reading what the assessment is that you take. You've, on the other hand, been long an advocate of a carbon tax here. Mm-hmm. And what's the case to be made for a carbon tax in terms of really ameliorating our problems with climate change as you see it?
Well, first of all, let me say what I was doing in the Middle East, and if I could then connect
it to carbon tax. I was making a connection
to
the two. But
let me try to do it. So I was I'm actually working on a documentary with a team from Showtime, a 60 Minutes producers, went out and raised money to do a documentary called Years of Living Dangerously on it's going to be 8 parts on Showtime next year on how climate is affecting, deforestation, ice melt, et cetera, range of issues. And the show I'm doing is on how climate change stresses help contribute to the Arab Awakening. So we were in Yemen, Syria, Turkey, and Egypt, and looking at each one of those. What I feel people don't see, and what is the big challenge right now for the Arab world, is that you have now the frailest Arab governments, all these sort of post-autocratic governments, having to deal, Michael, for the first time with massive issues of population, food, climate, And so we have the
massive unemployment.
Yeah, exactly. Massive unemployment. I'm glad you added that. So you have the frailest governments not having to deal with the biggest problems. And it's really not clear that they're up to it. You know, my argument in Hot, Flat, and Crowded for a carbon tax was simply that I believe that, you know, America still is a huge, you know, a leader by example for the world. If we go green, the world goes green. If we don't go green, China hides behind us, India hides behind us, you know, everybody else hides behind us. Right now, I think there's two arguments for a carbon tax. One is the obvious climate one. We've gone over 400 ppm, you know, of carbon in the atmosphere. But to me, we need money. We need to raise money. I can't think of a more intelligent way to raise revenue than taxing something we don't want and cutting taxes on things like labor that we do want.
Talking to Thomas Friedman, he is here for a New York Times forum, and he's on the air with us. His book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, is now available in paperback.
Updated in paperback. It's been in paperback for 20 years.
Available in a new version of paperback. And I should also mention that he's the author, of course, of That Used to Be Us, which I didn't mention, The World is Flat and so forth, and is hosting a conference tomorrow on business and technology called The Next New World. It will be at CityView at Metreon, I think open to the public?
No, I'm afraid not. You have to apply for a ticket through the Times.
Well, I'll tell you what is open to the public.
Please.
Our phone lines.
Great.
And you can join us in a number of ways. You can join us by calling us at our toll-free number if you'd like to talk to Tom Friedman. It's 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Also, join the conversation on our website and our Facebook page, or email us, forum at kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's at KQED Forum. You had a column when you were in Egypt that came out of your visit to Egypt about this hydroelectric dam that's being built
in Ethiopia. Yeah,
and it almost sounded like, boy, they're going to have to do what Mussolini did and invade Ethiopia or something. I mean, it's gotten really to be pretty volatile. But at the same time, here's a country that seems to be moving with the naming of this provincial governor, moving more and more toward being an Islamist and Sharia state.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering again about, does that mean more aggression toward Ethiopia potentially? This is our rights. I mean, the hydroelectric dam is something that obviously is as important to them maybe as nuclear forging ahead is to Iran.
Well, let's go back to, you know, I was given that example of Lebanon, no victor, no vanquished. And that, Michael, is my view of all the Arab Spring countries. That is, they've got to find any group, whether it's called the army, the secular liberals, or the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamists, who believe that in this kind of more majoritarian view, we've won. Now we get it all. OK, we get to rule however we want over everybody else. That's not going to work. And that's what the Muslim Brotherhood is going to learn and is learning the hard way in Egypt. The idea that just because you won the election, you can now do whatever you want for 4 years. They are going to fail. And what I fear, people are focused on Syria now. I think they're looking the wrong way. I think Egypt could experience some serious instability and turmoil very shortly, because on June 30th, the secular, less Islamist, nationalist part of Egypt, which is still the majority, if you look at the election results, they have planned a national, you know, march on June 30th. And fasten your seatbelts for that one.
Must be maddening in Israel. Where to stand on not only because Morsi at least put out a few olive leaves, but also particularly on Syria.
Yeah, the Israelis, I think, they're not saying this out loud, but if you just look, Michael, at how they're behaving, I think their view is Assad's going to win. And on balance, that's probably the best thing for them. They're thinking, because the real choices from their point of view are order and disorder, and he represents
the old Yiddish saying, this hour is bad enough, we don't need a new one.
Exactly.
Talking with Thomas Friedman, and we'll talk with you when we return. You're listening to the Forum Program. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, and he's back from visiting Yemen, Syria, and Turkey. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, getting his thoughts on the turmoil in Syria, U.S. jobs, NSA surveillance, among other topics. It's a wide canvas, and he always covers many subjects, to put it mildly. He's in San Francisco, by the way, to host The Next New World, a New York Times forum on technology and the global economy. And go to our callers and our emails, but Turkey. I mean, this was supposed to be the model in terms of stability and a paradigm for how a more moderate secular state that was largely Islamic in terms of its population could move in a democratic way. We're seeing some pretty disturbing things here, aren't we?
Well, it's really been an interesting phenomenon, Michael, because what it exposed. I've been going to Turkey pretty regularly. I've been on to the Erdogan thing, how he's been slowly kind of choking the press intimidating the opposition there. So none of this—
demanding Islamic regulations.
He will tell you we're demanding alcohol laws that America has and whatnot, but it's partly the way he tends to go about it and sort of hectoring people. But what is intriguing to me is that the message of Turkey is, you push people, you push people, you push people so far, and eventually, guess what? They push back. And this is really the young, more secular side of Turkey with a really heartfelt call to their prime minister to get out of my face. And what's so interesting about it is that basically he choked off the press. The day the big demonstration started, CNN Turk was running a show on penguins. And another major Turkish network did a show on risotto rather than show these demonstrations. And so you choke off the press. You enfeeble the opposition, which is already kind of feckless. So what do these kids do? They turn to Twitter and created, in effect, their own media and network. And they turned to the Taksim Square and created their own parliament. And they made themselves the new opposition.
It's like the Occupy movement, really, isn't it?
Yeah. It's broader based, though, I would argue.
And he still has the major part of the population behind him, though, doesn't
he? He's got half the population behind him. What's really sad about him, Erdogan has been a successful prime minister by any stretch of the imagination, and not just sort of raising incomes for rich people, raising incomes for poor people. He expanded health care. He's built roads and bridges. I have liberal friends who live in Istanbul who are like glad when their local alderman is from his party, not the opposition, because they're actually into good governance. So he actually has a lot of very important achievements. And you're watching a man soil a great legacy by just being kind of pigheaded.
Well, when you talk about pushback, and you spoke before about the importance of Egypt, much more important perhaps in the long run, even than Syria, these lemon squeezers, as you call them, as they're called in Egypt, I mean, these people who are also recoiling against Morsi are increasing in number too.
Well, what happened in Egypt is that, remember, Morsi won because many secular liberals voted for him as opposed to Ahmed Shafiq, who is the pro-Mubarak candidate. So you have the revolution and the liberals say, I cannot vote for the Mubarak guy. I'm going to give Morsi a chance. Well, hell hath no wrath like a liberal who votes for a conservative and then is disappointed. So what they've seen is Morsi, who told them I'm going to be inclusive, be very exclusive, not reach out to the opposition, really try to cram his people through, try to cram laws through. And as a result, they are just ferociously angry. What is scary about Egypt today, Mike, and I went to school there starting in 1974. I've never seen it as polarized as it is right now. The depth of not anger, rage between sort of the secular, non-Islamist part of Egypt, because some of it is also religious but more traditional, and Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood is really, really frightening.
I want to get to our callers, but please. Brings me to another subject just for a moment, or a parallel subject. There's a lot of hell hath no fury, like liberals who voted for Obama and feel now that he's a conservative and taking away their privacy rights and so forth.
Yeah.
I mean, all you have to do is read the blogs and realize that, or that he hasn't yet shut down Guantanamo, although in Berlin just yesterday he said he will indeed shut down Guantanamo, mm-hmm. said that again. I mean, there is a great deal of anger and feeling. On the other hand, the right is saying, he's a socialist, he's a Muslim and all this kind of stuff. But on the left is very angry at him now.
Yeah, I feel sorry for him. I honestly think he's trying to navigate what is a really sincerely difficult issue. And as I said earlier, I'm really glad we have people who are virulently ferociously monitoring all of this expansion of the national security state. At the same time, I'm really glad we have people out there alive to the fact that there are people out there who are still every day thinking of ways to disrupt our society. I mean, let's remember, what conversation would we be having today? We didn't have to listen to the NSA if the shoe bomber, Mr. Reed, if his shoes had gone up. What about the underwear bomber? What on Christmas Day? What conversation would we have if his underwear blew up and blew up that plane? What conversation would we be having if the guy in Yemen who built a bomb into the computer printer, if that bomb had actually gotten through and blown up? I mean, what conversation would we be having today? So that this is a principled argument, I think, between two principal positions. And the question is, how do you balance the two?
Well, I'm struck by the fact that those conversation monitorings didn't find out of calls made to Chechnya in the Boston Marathon.
Yeah.
But I'm also struck by the fact that when I think about President Obama, I think now see if this scenario makes sense to you, Tom. I mean, as a pragmatic politician, he goes in, he gets these security briefings, and he says, and this is not trying to excuse or rationalize, it's just sort of saying things I think like they probably went down. Because he's a very pragmatic guy. He's also a constitutional law expert, and he may have problems with the Fourth Amendment, but at the same time, he's being presented these scenarios and this information. He says, we've got to get what we can.
Because he's thinking, you know—
It's real politic.
Exactly. And that if I don't use every legal means to protect the country and something gets through, where am I? What will the criticism be of me? And yet, if I listen to every security guy who wants to plug every single hole, what will be my legacy in the rule of law realm?
Plus, he had his predecessor who was doing this. Let me go to our callers. And let's go first to Vaheen. Good morning. Or Vasen, excuse me.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Michael and Tom.
Hey.
Yeah, I was wondering, with all this intelligence, we ought to be able to target our capability to tap people's phone calls and everything. I know they will screen profiling if we say anything about deciding who to talk to. But I'll give you an example. One of my good friends who has a high-level security clearance in D.C. went back to visit India. And the questions they asked him was things like, where did you go in India? And he said he went somewhere. And they said, how did you get across the stream or something? And he said, yeah, I took a boat over there. And they insisted on knowing the name of the guy who rode the boat, and they wanted to interview him, which was ridiculous. And it's this kind of, you know, inane questions that they spend time on, which ends up being this vast amounts of data being collected, which is of no use. And instead, we should talk to the Israelis who do this thing very well, where they target the people who they know are potential terrorists, whatever, and restrict this collection of data. And again, I'm not suggesting profiling, but if that's the politically incorrect term to do what I'm suggesting, I think that's the only
I think that is what you're suggesting, because certainly the Israelis do a form of racial profiling. I mean, that's somebody tries to get on Al Al and they have questionable passport or place that they visited or whatever. That's the stuff they target.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the question that he was raising is that And you kind of know this when you're with security people, is that, you know, they always want to add on one more thing, you know, one more metal detector, or one more phone call operated, monitored, because, you know, for them, only something can go wrong, you know, so they're always looking. And then when you multiply that over thousands of people and multiple institutions, the thing has the real potential to run riot, which is why I cut the— I come out on the balance of let's try to do this in as controlled and legally monitored a way possible, because I fear what would happen if something got through even more to our civil rights and privacy rights. But at the same time, if Snowden is not prosecuted, I have like no problem with that personally. I think
he wouldn't call him a traitor like Dick Cheney did.
No. I honestly think in his own world he was trying to— selflessly motivated in the sense he really believed what he was doing. And I do think he has triggered an important debate. And I think that is just undeniable.
He also may have given away secrets.
And secrets. There's no easy answer here.
Let me get another caller. Norman, join us. Hi.
Yes. You know, I think it's unfortunate the sensibility that Thomas Friedman is a very smart guy. Has brought to bear in so many realms. For instance, we heard a few minutes ago, you know, asked about Iraq and the lessons to be drawn. Quote, we overpaid for it. We overpaid for it, which is sort of a what you might call jingo narcissism, to coin a term. You know, just the dire shortage of remorse, particularly given Thomas Friedman's very large role in cheering on, with his usual caveats, but cheering on the invasion of Iraq before it took place. And, you know, full disclosure, this is Norman Solomon. I chronicled his critique in my book, War Made Easy, his critique of foreign policy, and he did cheerlead in his sort of kind of erudite, glib way. He did cheerlead the invasion of Iraq before it took place, just as I chronicle in the book. He was gleeful in his columns about the bombing of Serbia, including Belgrade, civilian areas, just chortled and very, very gleeful about that bombing. One other point I'd like to make. His recent column about NSA surveillance is absolutely a formula for throwing away the First Amendment gradually in stages. The idea that somehow we should relinquish the sacred Fourth Amendment a little bit at a time, maybe not a little bit at a time, because if there's terrorism that takes place in a big way again in this country, then hold on to your hats. I mean, that is formulaic as an excuse, may I say, a bit of a craven way to accept this attack on our civil liberties.
Norman, let me thank you for the call and get a response from Tom Friedman.
Well, first of all, you know, I would invite, you know, I wrote a book called Longitudes and Attitudes that has all my columns leading up to the Iraq War. And what you will find if you read those columns is someone agonizing over a very, very difficult decision. To call it cheerleading is just stupid and obnoxious, okay? Number one. And on the question of the Fourth Amendment, as has been pointed out, there actually has been no case of abuse that has been reported so far with this program. Believe me, if there were 1, 2, 10, or 20, then I think we would be having a very different debate. And so to simply, he says, I'm dismissing the Fourth Amendment, which is ludicrous. I'm terribly agonized over this whole business. But to simply blithely say, oh, you know, you're just trying to use the threat of another terrorist attack, as if that isn't a live possibility, as if we haven't had 3 or 4 real examples of people trying to do things that, had they gotten through, I think would have led to even worse restrictions on privacy and civil liberties.
We've also had, and let me thank Norman for the call, 3 or 4 examples with Bradley Manning, with Julian Assange, and now with Edward Snowden of what the president, I think, correctly framed ought to be a national conversation about this, but where a national conversation can take us. And then you have people like Dan Ellsberg who say, this has just got to be totally transparent. I mean, since when does a sovereign state, particularly the most powerful state in the world, have to be totally transparent? Intelligence is done and has been done in all kinds of clandestine ways since time immemorial, probably.
I mean, should we announce to the Nazis that we are breaking their code?
There you go. Let me get another caller on here. This is Shell from Hayward. Good morning.
Good morning. I was wondering if the cell phone contracts are similar to computer contracts. When you go online, first boot up under the terms of service, it says any information that is, you know, sent over or accessed from the Internet is available under this contract to the United States government. And I think that apparently, there's not many people who read the entire contract, and I'm assuming that it goes the same with cell phones. And I want another question, if I could, afterwards about.
Let's take that first one first here.
I'm not. That's above my skill set.
Tom is saying it's sort of not in his realm. But so, what's your next question?
I was told when the media topic was the media's performance, influence, and responsibilities that if there were web addresses so that people can comment about what's in their daily publications, that the economic fallout would hit like a ton of bricks. I don't know.
Okay, that sounds more like a comment than a question, and I thank you for it. Let me get on another caller here. Reza is next. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call. This is Reza from San Francisco. Somewhat of a neutral question. I think all of these security issues are going to be paled in comparison when the real effects of global warming start to hit, and we get migration and you know, all of the fights that will ensue due to the resources and everything. So my question is, one of the often stated reasons why we don't wholeheartedly participate is the cost of 2-3% to the economy, the U.S., in order for us to go in and actually deal with global warming on a more realistic level, at the Kyoto type of levels, it would cost us 2 to 3% to the economy. And on the flip side of that, the annual growth is 2 to 3%. So I'm just kind of curious, does that mean effectively if we put it into high gear for dealing with global warming, does that mean that essentially we've regressed by a year or two in the standard of living, or the math kind of doesn't add up, and that the excuse, the economy is the excuse they always use not to do this? So I want to better understand that.
Well, it's a very good question. You know, I think the couple answers I would give is to rest. One is that, you know, I've just been in Egypt, as I said, and so what are some of the things you see in Egypt if you go to Egypt today? One is that about 10 days ago, it was 113 degrees Fahrenheit in Cairo, which was 20 degrees above the average temperature on that particular day. So you're seeing now these really nonlinear temperature spikes, number one, which is really scary because it combines with a country that is running out of money, so it can't buy fuel, so people can't get air conditioning and whatnot in certainly the regularity that you need. What's happening with the Nile basin, the Nile Delta, is that for several reasons, one, the less silt coming down because of the Aswan Dam, the discovery of natural gas, which is sort of sinking the earth, and then the rise of sea level is leading to saltwater intrusion now into the Nile Delta. And then, of course, you have the challenge of the Ethiopian Dam, which isn't going to cut off the Nile, but it's going to build up a lake behind it. You're going to get evaporation, more evaporation, some of these other challenges. So I think Reza's, you know, point in general is very true, that I think in 10 years – These are the only issues that a country like Egypt is going to be talking about. Can we feed ourselves? Can we preserve the agricultural system we have? And how do we make ourselves resilient to and adapt to it's going to be a cost beyond them, rising sea levels.
Let me thank Reza for the call. Where are you on fracking? You have a position?
My position on fracking is that I think it's something that, if done under proper regulation, is something we should do on one condition, that it's matched with a carbon tax, so it is not, so that is a bridge for a clean energy future, not a ditch. Because otherwise we get addicted just to slightly less polluting, slightly less global warming form of fossil fuels.
Let me read some emails from listeners. A listener writes, here are some thoughts about U.S. jobs. Why is the approach job creation rather than job retention? Why not have a protective tariff to prevent jobs from being exported without severe penalties? And why not reduce importation of foreign workers who compete for jobs with native workers? Government is not good at creating jobs, but it knows how to levy tariffs. It knows how to issue work visas. Why give government a role in which it has no expertise, namely creating jobs?
Well, it's an interesting question. And I would say, I think the most important thing I would say to that reader, though, Michael, is that the vast majority of jobs do not get outsourced to India or to Mexico or to China. They get outsourced to the past. They're made obsolete. We used to have a receptionist at the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. We don't know. We have a microchip instead. We got voicemail. That job is not filled by someone from Mexico. It's filled by a microchip. And that's really not the vast majority of job, you know, churn and change is driven by technology. It's not to say globalization doesn't matter. But, you know, that's something displacing lower wage jobs with higher wage jobs is something that's gone on from time immemorial. Britain outsourced textile jobs to America, you know, back in the 1800s. So I don't think you're going to stop that. If horses could have voted, there never would have been cars. The point to me is always be trying to move up the knowledge chain on jobs and always trying to be educating your people so more and more of them can acquire and do those jobs. I think that's the only sustainable strategy.
We've talked about changes as a result of technology, not only the job market, but we were talking about the fact that the whole terrain of what's available in jobs has changed because of technology to a great degree. And I'm not a cheerleader for technology, but I'm no naysayer where technology is concerned. But yeah. What about also the argument that you hear that it's almost reframing neuroscience in many respects? You got kids who are, you know, just looking at their iPhones or looking at a virtual world almost all the time. There was a viral video, in fact, of these young people, and they were sitting all looking at their iPhones, and one young woman had a thing on it that said bachelorette, so you could tell it was a bachelorette party. And then they said, oh, we're going to take pictures for Facebook now. So then they all look like they're having a good time. And then they went back right to their iPhones and so forth. I mean, there's a little parable in there that, yeah, you know, tells us about the changes in technology.
Well, you know, I'm a really, I said I'm 59, I'm soon to turn 60, and so I'm really old-fashioned, Michael. I don't, the New York Times tweets my column, but I really don't do much Twitter, really don't do Facebook, really don't do LinkedIn. I just go places and sit down and talk to people. That's how I learn. And maybe the new generation has their brains wired differently and will learn differently, and if they do, God bless them. But I think that there's a real danger in getting addicted to these things and losing touch with the real world. And so I'm very still old-fashioned, hands-on reporter. Came in working on a typewriter. I'll go on working on a computer, but I'm not I know how I learn, and served me well so far.
We both have dinosaur qualities without putting us in a reptile category. Here's Leonard who writes, what in the end supports the animosity between Iran and Israel? It seems they have a common adversary in Arab nationalism. Mightn't a detente between Israel and Iran be a keystone to Mideast stability?
Very good question. And there are many who argue, Michael, that Turkey, Iran, and Israel are fated by history and geography to be friends, to be allies. Because they all
The Turks and the Israelis were until
right, exactly.
A couple boats went,
and the Iranians and Israelis were, you know, during the days of the Shah,
because
of the natural. They all obviously have rivalry or antipathy with certain Arab countries. You know, Iran is a great civilization, and I've been to Iran twice. Was banned for life both times afterwards, but I think I'll be able to get back there again. And there's nothing that would change the Middle East more positively than moderation, you know, in Iran's leadership that allowed for a more democratic and consensual Iran. This is a country with very liberated women. Women have a long tradition in the workforce there. It's not Saudi Arabia. It's a very, very different – it's a great civilization. And it's too bad right now. I think it's been captured not by an Islamic government but by an extreme Islamic government.
And the mullahs are still in charge.
Yeah, very much so. And so it can't really play, I think, the enormously important civilizing role that it could play.
Another listener writes, I'm still waiting for a foreign policy discussion with a non-American exceptionalist, i.e. an objective analysis and not one infused with double standards and pure patriotism and nationalism. Mm-hmm. Even just a plain old realist such as Scowcroft would be a breath of fresh air from the neocons, liberal innovationists, and other U.S. flag wavers that populate these nonetheless interesting discussions. You've been accused of American exceptionalism. Raise your right hand. How do you plead?
Yeah, I believe America's an amazing country and unbalanced, and it's always unbalanced. Plays a positive role in the world, and we make our mistakes, but I would hate to see a world, you know, without American power and influence, a world that would be shaped by China or Russia, or the world that would be tilted by them or by nobody at all. So I make no apologies for that. I think we are on balance a very important force for stabilizing the global commons, promoting democracy and freedom. Usually, not always, when it conflicts with certain national interests. All this is unbalanced, but I'm proud of that. Make no apologies for it.
Here's Ken who writes, how is it NSA gets billions for data centers to spy on Americans, yet the VA records are on paper in boxes with a 5-year backlog? How are NSA Fourth Amendment violations a higher priority than supporting troops?
Great question. And why I go back to something I said earlier, that whatever one thinks about where you should cut the balance between privacy and protecting against another major terrorist attack. Snowden has triggered a debate, and maybe part of that will be this question as well, because what happened after 9/11 is that this thing ran riot, and I certainly feel I overreacted, and so I don't want to see that happen again.
We'll go to another call, and that's you, Tim. Join us on Forum. Good morning.
Yes, I support a carbon tax like Mr. Friedman does, but he gave two reasons in support, and one of those I think is not a good reason.
Uh-huh.
I agree we should disincentivize carbon emissions with the tax, but I think it's a mistake to try to raise revenue with it because that will make it very difficult to get bipartisan support for such a tax. I think it needs to be revenue neutral and progressivity neutral to have a hope of getting past both parties and being a real piece of legislation that will pass. So I'll take my answer up here.
All right. Thank you for the question.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Former Secretary of State George Shultz shares that view as well. I personally, if it were a choice, I'll accept any carbon tax, revenue neutral or with, you know, revenue positive. I just think, though, that we are heading for a period as the baby boomers retire where we're going to need revenue. And I can't think of a better way to get it than with a carbon tax rather than cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare, or raising payroll taxes or income taxes. So that's where I come down, where I come. It is optimal, but I'll take anything.
Only got a couple of minutes left. I want to talk about two recent things with you. President Obama in Berlin said we're going to move forward and reduce nuclear armaments. He's been talking about this for a while. I mean, can he really get the job done?
Kind of an evergreen, Michael. You're over in Europe, call for ending nuclear weapons. But, you know, I just wish we could get a few more simple things right at home, you know.
Well, we're also talking about sitting down and talking with the Taliban. Mm-hmm. I mean, are you positive, optimistic, sanguine on that score?
You know, I really don't know enough about the ins and outs of Taliban politics, whether the people we're talking to really represent the Taliban. I can truly deliver them. But I know this, there is nothing that would be more in our interest than a negotiated settlement in Afghanistan that allows for power sharing, allows for us to bring our troops home and not see Afghanistan collapse into that kind of horrific ultra-jihadist Taliban regime that denied women or young girls even the chance to go to school.
Almost sounds like they're brokering a kind of compromise where they'll say, well, you don't have to necessarily move forward on that as long as you don't let Al-Qaeda in or you
right.
don't act as a...
Stay in your space. Let the people who have acquired new freedoms as a result of, you know, the last 10 years of post-Taliban rule have them. Stay in your space. You live as you live. I go back to where I started. In every one of these countries, Michael, you have incredibly diverse populations. Without the principle of no victor, no vanquished, you are not going to see political stability in any of them.
Always good to have you here. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thomas Friedman. And From Beirut to Jerusalem, new updated version is out there in paperback. And he's going to be hosting a conference tomorrow on business and technology called the Next New World Conference. Unfortunately, it's not open to the public, but you can find out certainly. Well, you can go on YouTube in another day and find out everything you need to know. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.